I am a mother.
A father.
Son.
Daughter.
Brother.
A sister.
I am a student.
A stay-at-home mom.
Construction worker.
Volunteer.
I am loving.
Smart.
Funny.
Generous.
Way too generous.
I am all of the amazing things you see.
But there's something you can't see.
Or don't see.
Something that I don't let anybody see.
Like when I'm alone.
In a room full of people.
I can't get out of bed.
And maybe I've gained weight.
Or lost weight.
Why do men always lose weight?
It can get dark in here.
Really dark.
Addicted to food.
The web.
Work.
Sex.
Alcohol.
Something to take the pain away.
To feel happy.
To feel something.
Anything.
Nothing.
Because depression isn't a mood.
It's not a passing thing.
Or a bad day.
It's a disease.
I can't just get over it.
It feels like I'm underwater.
Drowning.
And sometimes I think you'd be better off without me.
I am telling you this. All of this.
Because I need help.
And you are my wife.
My dad.
My husband.
My kids.
My boss.
So please, don't judge me.
Leave me.
Fire me.
Please, be patient.
Don't give up on me.
Just be there for as long as it takes.
Just because you can't see it, doesn't mean it isn't real.
So this morning, one of the things that we are going to acknowledge at the very beginning is that this is uncomfortable and it is okay to be uncomfortable. This idea started because, frankly, the Lake Norman High School community experienced the loss of a student who experienced death by suicide right around Easter and the week after Easter. And so some of the West folks knew that young man. So that had an impact on our faith community. And frankly, as a pastor, honestly, over the last several weeks, I've had four or five different people talk to me, some here locally, some not locally, about their own thoughts of depression. And it's a heavy topic, but it is so important. And I think there are so many myths that we attach to the ideas of clinical depression and suicide. One of the things that we talked about last week, and I'm not into self-promotion, but if you weren't with us last week, I do invite you to go listen to that message because we talk about some of the things around faith and perspective around the issue of death by suicide, but that people who experience death by suicide are selfish, that they're some of the most selfish people ever. And, you know, frankly, that's just not what I believe, what professionals believe, and also where is God in suicide? And so we're going to talk about that at the very end after we hear from our professionals. This also started from the book 13 Reasons Why. And I read that book over Christmas break, and frankly, I was intrigued by it. I couldn't put it down. It tells the story of a young woman named Hannah Baker, and she experiences what our own teens experience in their own lives. If you watch the show, you will think, oh, you know, surely that does not all happen. And honestly, it may not all happen to one person, but I think everybody can agree, whether we approve of the show or not, that the things that the teens deal with in that show are real, and it's stuff that our teenagers face every day. So I wanted to share that with you. Also, I do think good things come from hard conversations. And, you know, we all see the negative stuff that happens in the news. Well, this week, something positive came out of the 13 Reasons Why conversation and TV show. And I wanted to share that with you. It is Oxford High School in Michigan, and the dean of the high school decided one of the students experienced death by suicide, and she decided that she wanted to tackle a project that would make a difference in that local school. So she is leading this initiative called 13 Reasons Why Not. I watched the series. I thought it accurately depicted the problems that teenagers in high school are facing now, but it was incredibly troubling to me that suicide was portrayed as being almost inevitable, like she had no other option. The idea was to come up with 13 reasons why not, because that was not portrayed in the show. Even though it can get very dark, there is always hope. Our message is that there are no 13 reasons why. Suicide is not an option. The project was kept secret, so while students were expecting to hear Monday morning announcements, like always, they were surprised to hear the voice of senior Riley Junty. Here are Riley's words. Worthless, self-centered, no morals, easy, grimy, cake face. You would be better off dead. That's just the start of what you would label me as every day for 2 years, Junty said in her recording. At the end of the recording, instead of naming the person that she was talking about, she thanked a classmate. This tape is for you, Elise Godfrey. You saw me when no one else did. And you continue to listen, share, and appreciate the small things with me. Thank you for your kindness that I cannot repay. You are one of my 13 reasons why not. There's one verse in Matthew, and it says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall inherit or see the kingdom of God." When Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful," he meant blessed are the people who look at things from the perspective of those that they are in relationship with. If you have mercy for someone and with someone, it means you move out of your own way and you don't always look at it with your lens, but you look at it with the lens of the other person. And so this morning, that's going to be a little bit of what we talk about. Would you please give a warm West welcome to our professionals that are here with us this morning? If you guys will come on up. I feel like Oprah. I've always wanted to feel like Oprah, and I would like to have Oprah's money and clout. If you guys want to just tell them your names before we get started with our questions.
Great. My name is Jason Master. I am a psychiatrist locally here in Mooresville.
My name is Dr. Cynthia Sapp, and I am in private practice in Davidson.
My name is Ashley Thompson, and I am in private practice here in Mooresville.
And thank you guys, really, for being here. They are wickedly smart people. I had the opportunity to spend about 45 minutes with them before worship, and so I really think you will be blessed this morning. So, Dr. Master, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on the show, 13 Reasons Why, the ways it's productive, counterproductive, all that kind of stuff?
Well, thank you. I think, for me, probably one of the most difficult things is not to be critical. So that's one of the things I'm trying to work on. So it would be very easy to say all of the things that I believe are wrong with the show. But I think probably the single most positive thing out of it is that it is provoking dialogue. It's at least getting us talking about a very, very uncomfortable subject, and that is depression, and then, of course, suicide that goes along with it. As far as the show and how it portrays things, certainly an eye-opener for me. I think perhaps I was a bit naive in terms of what kids may actually be going through. We grew up in a very different time and with social media and cyberbullying. So I think it was educational for me because I think from my understanding is that was portrayed pretty accurately, so that's another good thing. In terms of how it related to suicide, how some of the events were portrayed. It was a TV mature rating, and yet it was a while before I even became aware of it, and actually I think all the kids were aware of it well before even I was as a parent and as a professional. So that's a very difficult thing. I think if their target audience was to help kids, then perhaps they should have made it a little bit more kid-friendly. I think there is a lot of very graphic nature to it, and even to the extent that as an adult and as a mental health practitioner, a couple of the scenes I think could literally create post-traumatic stress, which is a very serious disorder in addition to depression, in viewers, because it was extremely graphic. I think that it also sent certain messages that were not appropriate with regards to suicide and what the aftermath of it is, what the reasons actually behind it are. So it definitely was not my favorite show in terms of an accurate portrayal.
Thanks.
And just to build on that a little bit, the suicide prevention experts and communities, they have a great concern of what's called the contagion effect or copycat effect. And that is what we're seeing across the country and in Canada, is that hospitals are reporting an increased spike of students who are admitted for increased incidents of self-harm and suicide attempts. So, and they're stating their association with the show. So that's something that everybody's very aware of, and you know, something that we want to talk about when we decide whether we're going to let our teens watch the show, partially for the reasons that he's talking about.
They're trying to tell you a very subliminal message to hold the microphones closer, please. And okay. So, because there are a lot of people, so you have to...
to the mouth.
It flashed up on the screen behind us, so hold them up there. All right, thanks.
You know, I absolutely agree, but I think one of the positive things that came out of the show is that anybody who watched the show got to see that Hannah Baker, the main character, her perspective was oftentimes very different from the perspectives of the other characters. So I think that it really allowed us to take some perspective sharing, understanding that what you might mean is something insignificant or something small somebody else can take, and it can be a really big deal to them. So I think that's a great message for our teens. As I've talked with teenagers about it, they're, you know, saying this is their real life, and it was helpful for them to realize that something really small could get blown way out of proportion. And also for us as adults, parents, you know, aunts, uncles, I think it's great for us to be able to understand that, you know, sometimes we might say to our teenager, oh, it's really not that big of a deal. It is a big deal for them. So I think that that's been something really helpful that's come out of the show.
And parents, if you think that your child or teenager has never heard of the show, that's not realistic. You are wrong. And we all talked about that. So they know what's on Netflix way quicker than we do. So
yeah, and not just high schoolers. Middle schoolers are watching this show.
And some elementary.
Well.
And it would be highly inappropriate for them.
It was like sex ed for me. Like, I was like, oh, my. Wow. I mean, you know, that shows you how cultured I am. But, I mean, it is that graphic. So we do encourage you to have conversation with your kids around this show. So, Dr. Sapp, will you... This was a question, actually, from some of the West folks. Will you talk about how do you tell if someone is struggling with depression? And will you also speak to us about, all of you, speak to us about the issue of clinical depression? I think I've heard from people that when they have found that they are clinically depressed, people will say to them, well, just snap out of it. You know, this is not as bad as you think it is. You know, you just need some rest or blah, blah, blah. And that they glaze over it. And clinical depression and depression is real. So would you guys speak to that, starting with Dr. Sapp?
Sure. So there is a book called the DSM-5 that lists, and we use it as a diagnostic manual. And to diagnose clinical depression, there's a series of clusters of symptoms that if you check enough of these boxes over at least a two-week period of time, then you are clinically depressed. So let me just tell you what some of those symptoms are. When someone comes in to me and they report that they're sad, that they're tearful more than they would be. They've also perhaps lost interest in activities that they usually like to do. Maybe they like to hang out at football games with their friends, but now they could take it or leave it. Maybe they're not as interested in their schoolwork. Loss of concentration. They try to do their schoolwork, but they really can't focus, or they can't make decisions on how to prioritize their time.
They a lot of times have disruptions in their sleep. You saw that in the video, and that can go one way or the other. They either, they've got thoughts running through their head, and they can't sleep no matter how hard they try, or they fall asleep and they can't stay asleep. Or it could go the other way, and they're sleeping 10 to 12 hours a day. They can't get up out of bed. They're tired. They don't feel refreshed when they get up. Same with appetite, changes in appetite. Maybe they're not eating and you notice that they're losing weight, or it could go the other way and they're headed for the comfort food and you see their weight going up. Or they're preoccupied with death, or they're talking about death and not fear of dying, but talking about not wanting to be here, talking about being lonely, talking about feeling hopeless. Maybe they're really fatigued. Then you really get a sense of the pain, the emotional pain that they're going through. So those are some of the clusters of the symptoms that we look for. And then in terms of how that translates into how we look for suicide, you want to be aware of some of these symptoms. And what you would notice is, gosh, you know, there's something different with my friend. They're not quite the same that they were before. They used to be outgoing and now they're withdrawn. Perhaps they took great care in their appearance and now they just kind of look disheveled. Again, they may be preoccupied with death. They're writing poems about death. Writing letters, or maybe some of their essays to teachers seem really, really, really dark. They could be more easily agitated, particularly in teens. So those are just some of the things. And if you notice that something is off, and I think Ashley's going to speak to this. I mean, you want to reach out, you want to engage, you want to be that person to connect and offer hope. And there's, you know, questions you can ask and things that you can do for that. But those are some of the main clusters. And if they are talking about wanting to die and not wanting to go on, stop the show. Then you want to stop right there and ask questions, and we've got to get them to help immediately. And you know, there's a difference, and we'll speak to this in a minute, in terms of whether someone is saying, I don't want to live anymore, to I really don't want to live, and here's how I've thought about killing myself, and oh, by the way, I have this razor or these pills, and oh, by the way, this is when I'm thinking about doing it. I mean, the lethality increases as you move along that continuum. And a lot of people who attempt and experience death by suicide are suffering from clinical depression, so we want to be aware of that.
Do you have anything to add?
The only thing that I would add, that's obviously a very comprehensive list of symptoms, and Dr. Sapp is right, you know, those all come out of the DSM-5, but with teens, and she spoke to this just a little bit, sometimes it looks a little bit different. You know, with teenagers, a lot of times they're more angry. They're spending more time alone in their room, which is a little hard for those of us to gauge who have 15, 16, 17-year-olds, because they're always in their room. But you know, maybe it's hard to get them to come out. They're just not interacting nearly as much. Maybe they are doing some self-injury, some cutting. Maybe they're using drugs or alcohol to numb the pain. So those are some of the other things I think that we look for, particularly in teenagers.
Comment I would probably want to make is as a psychiatrist, I'm also a physician and a medical doctor. So I tend to also medicalize mental health. I liked the video. It certainly does not discriminate. And that is to say there were all sorts of different ethnicities that were portrayed in that video. So whether it's socioeconomic status, depression, and other mental health issues does not discriminate. The incidence of depression and schizophrenia and other mental health problems is really the same in virtually every country. When I look at depression and clinical depression, everybody has a right to be sad. Everybody has a right to feel grief. Everyone has a right to be unhappy because things aren't going their way. But there's a big difference between depression clinical depression and sadness or unhappiness. There are psychological, but there are also biological factors of depression. And that is to say, our brain is an organ in our body, and it does have a specific job to do. When our brain is not functioning correctly, just like any other organ in our body, if it's your pancreas, that isn't balanced correctly, then a person has blood sugars that are out of control, and that is called diabetes. However, when it's our brain that's out of order, a person can suffer from dementia, Parkinson's disease, depression, anxiety, panic attacks, schizophrenia. So it is actually a brain disorder. It's not just simply being sad. So there's the biological imbalances that can occur in a person's brain. And then there are the psychological stressors, or people who will come to me and say, oh, well, I have a situational depression. That may be true, but that situation may have also progressed them to the point where they actually have a biological depression as well, where medications can be very helpful. I think it is important to know that there are not only biological and psychological factors that contribute to depression. When it comes to a treatment, there's also biological and psychological treatments. And, you know, the psychology of it, learning coping mechanisms, going to see a therapist or a counselor to learn how to deal with your issues better or how to think about things differently is certainly going to be very helpful. But medications and trying to restore some of the balances in the brain is going to be an important part of treatment as well.
Well, and one of the things the research shows is that the combination of the therapy and the medication together give you sort of the biggest bang for your buck in terms of improving mood and holding it stable over time for the reasons that you just said.
I joke with the people of West that I have a wing, that my personal counselor, I have funded a wing in his house. I call it the Smith wing. I am proud of that. You know, it is not embarrassing to say you need help. And one of the things that I really love about West is the leadership here has this thing called Pastor's Discretionary Fund. And people, when they tithe, donate their resources to West, sometimes we'll mark Pastor's Discretionary. And we use that money to pay for people to go see a counselor. Because I'm a pastor, and I will pray with you, but I'm not qualified like these folks are. So I will refer people on. And there is nothing to be embarrassed about, to need to seek help. And so I hope if you walk away with anything today, that will be one of the things that you walk away with, that it is okay to say, I'm sad, I'm struggling, and I need some help, and I need somebody to talk to. And please, please do reach out for that help. Dr. Thompson, what do we do if we recognize someone, one of our friends or a loved one, looks like they, or they're acting like they need some help? What do we do?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the additional advanced degree, but I'm not a doctor.
Oh, okay. I want you to be one, so it's all good.
Thank you very much. But I am a licensed counselor, so I can still speak to that.
Okay.
So if you feel like somebody that you know or love needs help, the first thing is being willing to acknowledge that depression is a real illness. It's not something that they can just snap out of. So saying things like, oh, it'll be fine, or, you know, just get it together, it doesn't work. So acknowledging that it's a real illness, educate yourself. If it's your husband or your wife or your child or your parent or your friend, learn as much as you can about depression. That's not so that you can provide them the treatment, but that's just so that you understand what's going on with them and maybe you can better relate to some of what they're experiencing. And then I would say the most important thing is if it's a clinical type of depression, if it's not, you know, just something small and situational, allow them to get help, you know, walk them through that process. Let them know, like, I will be here for you. I'll be here with you. Let's do this together and get them to a professional who really can help.
Thank you. All right, Dr. Master, if you will address the next question that I didn't write down, so I don't know what it is, if you'll just talk about it and tell them what the question is. Look, at West, you just have to roll with
it. It's sometimes how to talk to someone about depression.
Oh, good. Be sensitive. That's
how can
what I
we
wrote
be
down.
Sensitive and approach the subject to someone? Of course, I got to put my glasses down so I can read that because these are for farsightedness. Anyway, how can we be sensitive? That is a very difficult question. The reality is that mental health is still stigmatized. I've oftentimes joked with my patients saying that I wish this was Southern California and it was simply chic to have a shrink or to have a counselor or a therapist. And that isn't always the case. But to know and understand that mental health is pretty universal and everybody does have their problems. So I think in many ways it is somewhat easy to at least understand and be sensitive to others' needs when it comes to mental health. I think another really important factor is just not to be uncomfortable. Suicide, you know, you've mentioned a number of times that this is an uncomfortable subject. Although that may in fact be the case, the reality of it is that people are uncomfortable, but talking about it doesn't actually make it more likely. Mm. That is something that people fear a lot.
Thank you for pointing that out.
If I talk to someone or if I ask them about suicide, I ask every single patient pretty much every single day, have you thought about hurting yourself? That's not going to put an idea in their head that they hadn't thought of before. So just don't be afraid to talk about it. It may be uncomfortable, but it's not going to change anything.
Good.
For the worse, that is.
Yeah.
And one of the things in the research and associated with that is, and it really sticks with me, is when folks are contemplating suicide, they're really, most of them are conflicted up until the very end when they make that decision. And, you know, what we're finding, especially with people who have survived attempts, is that they really don't want to die. What they really want is to have an escape from the pain that they're feeling. So when we're talking with them, that's what we want to do. We want to engage with them. We want them to know that they're not in this alone. We want to get them to a mental health professional and a physician that can help with the depression. And because, you know, a couple of the biggest predictors of then making an attempt are feeling like they're a burden, feeling like that their family would be, or family and friends would be better off without them, and feeling lonely. So don't be afraid to ask the questions, connect, understand that this is more about the pain that they're feeling, their level of stress has overwhelmed their coping mechanisms, and not really wanting to die.
From the pastoral perspective, that's why I say, you know, we say it's selfish, but when people are sick, mentally ill, then they are struggling. So it is not a selfish act. They are reaching out and trying to cope in the only way that they know how. And unless you've been clinically depressed, you don't understand that. So that is why I get my hair stands up a little when people say, well, that's the most selfish thing they could have done. We feel that way because we are devastated. But at that time, they do not see a way out. And they do think that the world, their family, their loved ones, they think people are better off without them. So please, you know, I'm not advocating it at all, but understand that that is what people feel when they find themselves in that place. So I want you guys to clap if you have ever been bullied or you have, you know someone that's been bullied. Will you clap? So clearly, a large representation. Dr. Sapp, will you talk about bullying?
And really, I want to concentrate on cyberbullying. With traditional bullying, it's an aggressive behavior where somebody either verbally, physically, or socially, trying to ruin somebody's reputation, is trying to harm or embarrass somebody else. And now it's really amped up with the advancement of technology and social media. And the reason, you know, some of the reasons that cyberbullying is different is that it can happen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It can reach the victim when they're alone. It is hard to erase a message once you hit that send. It's basically being published, and it reaches a wide audience. And I think in the 13 Reasons Why, and there were a couple scenes, I think, with the inappropriate picture of Hannah, you know, people are sitting in their class and you're hearing the notifier, bing, 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 bing. They're all going off, and this was an inappropriate, embarrassing picture that ended up affecting her reputation. What we know in terms of the connection between bullying and suicide, and this statistic I just saw the other day, that students who are experience cyberbullying are twice as likely to attempt suicide than students who don't. In terms of prevalence of cyberbullying, depending on the study you read, it's at least 50% have been cyberbullied at least once, and about 25 to 28% experience repeated bullying, which can include, again, threats, embarrassing pictures. And 1 out of 10 teens has had pictures taken without their permission that have been put on the internet. And also, about 80% of teens, I actually think it's higher, but it says 80% of teens, their cell phone is their main device of communication, which also makes it the main device that's used for cyberbullying. So parents, really talk to your teens and your kids about how they use their phones and how their words and actions affect the teens. I don't know if I just said this, but in terms of how many parents know, only about 1 in 10 kids who are cyberbullied tell their parents. So they really don't talk to their parents about it. That needs to change.
And a good thing to do is to talk to your kids about it, and teens, talk to your parents about it before it happens. Talk about, so how can we help you if you find yourself experiencing a situation where you are being bullied? How do you want me to help you? What are some good boundaries that I can put around my parenting so that I can help you at that time? It's always better to talk about a subject before you find yourself in the middle of a subject. So it is good, have those conversations today. And teens, don't think your parents are just being bullies by trying to see your cell phones. It's because they really do care about you. And I see you staring at your parents right now, and that's okay. It's all good. They love you and they want to help you. So please don't be ashamed when you find yourself in situations that are bigger than you know how to handle, because frankly, people are mean. I mean, that is sad, but that is the reality that we live in. People live out of their own realities, and people are just not all kind people. So please be aware of that.
Well, and one final thing about the connection is the studies that have looked at the link between bullying and cyberbullying and suicide, it's not so much that the act of the bullying itself causes a suicide attempt, it's that it exacerbates conditions like depression, anxiety, shame, low self-esteem in the lives of kids and teens that are already struggling with stressful things. So
I'm going to just add one more thing to that, because this does get back to the show, 13 Reasons Why. A common theme throughout that show, for anyone who hasn't watched it, was blaming the bullies for Hannah's suicide. And there were a number of different statements that were said, yeah, we all killed Hannah. And that's just simply not true. It's not true. No one, I mean, did they bully her? Yes. But no one actually made her do that. That was a combination of her inability to manage and cope with her feelings. She wasn't getting the help that she needed. She could have suffered from clinical depression, could have benefited from medications. There's all sorts of things. And she made a choice, granted, a choice that she may not have felt she had to make. That was her only option to escape the pain that she was in. But the reality of it is that nobody is responsible for someone else's suicide.
Which is a great lead into the last question. Ashley, if you'll speak to the topic of survivor guilt.
Yeah, so people have survivor guilt for a number of reasons. Most of the time, survivor guilt is talked about after a major disaster. People in the military experience survivor guilt. We're in this case kind of talking about it, from the show 13 Reasons Why, survivor guilt of suicide. But the symptoms of survivor guilt oftentimes can be nightmares, flashbacks. People will become obsessed over the event. They'll begin to question the meaning of life. Maybe they will be very fearful or feel nothing at all, feel sort of numb. And sometimes they'll use drugs or alcohol to numb the pain. But I wanted to talk a little bit about how to cope with survivor guilt. One of the most important things is just keeping a regular routine, trying to put one foot in front of the other while you go through the grief process, because the grief process is real and it's healthy. So you have to just kind of keep going with your regular routine, trying to eat healthy, getting enough sleep. Talk to someone you trust. We've been trying to emphasize how important it is to have someone that you trust that you can open up to. So being willing to talk about it Do something to memorialize the person. Do something that allows you to celebrate their memory. Don't be afraid to talk about the person. Don't be afraid to remember the good times. Those are all really important things to do when dealing with survivor guilt.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything else to add?
Literally, we could talk for hours about this. It is a difficult topic. I think one of the things, I know I didn't coin the phrase, but suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And it is a finality to things. And when a person is in that frame of mind and they're thinking about taking their own life, they're really not thinking about anything else. It is also a very difficult thing to prevent because the people who are really wanting to do it oftentimes are going to keep that a secret, as Hannah seemingly had kept it a secret as well. The other thing to kind of think of is, in addition to that, it is also usually a crisis in particular, and that's when it is most important to intervene. Because when a person becomes actively suicidal, meaning they've already developed a plan and they actually have an intention, if you can figure that out, if you can find out about it and you can get them help, it may be 2, 3, 4 days, maybe a week where that person is actively, you know, thinking about it. It's not to say that their depression is going to clear up overnight, but if you can get them through that immediate crisis, a lot of times you can then move forward and do a lot of good for them. There was an interesting study, and the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco is a pretty popular place for people to commit suicide. That or the Brooklyn Bridge, jumping off of bridges is a well-known thing. Access to suicide really increases risk as well, and that might mean access to guns at home or a bridge like in San Francisco. But as you can imagine, most people who do jump from a bridge of that height do perish. They do die. There are some survivors. And there was a study done, and they talked to the survivors of jumpers off the Golden Gate Bridge, and almost across the board, not everybody, but there was such a high percentage of those jumpers who survived who retold the story of what they did, and when they stepped off, almost all of them said, "Oh my God, what did I do? Hmm. What did I do?" In my practice, when I have someone who talks to me about suicide, I generally ask them, "Well, what is it? You know, you've thought about it. You think about it on a regular basis. What is it that keeps you from committing suicide?" And they generally say the two biggest reasons are faith and family. Faith and family. It's a recurring theme. For those of us who may feel like we don't have family, I think that something I hear in the South, because I'm from up north, is a lot of people refer to their church family. Hmm. So I think that's an important thing, too, is that if they have faith and they have a church, well, then they have a family, whether or not they have a biological family.
Thank you. And whether it's West or any, we have amazing churches here in this local area. And I don't care if you land here. I hope you land somewhere if you don't already have a church family. Will you give these guys a warm and special thank you? We are so grateful that they were here last Sunday. We talked about this, and I'm so glad that Dr. Master ended talking about faith. Some of the teens of West were talking about that they had heard other teens talking about the young man that experienced death by suicide and whether or not he was in heaven. And so I said this last Sunday at the end of the message, and I will say it again today. We believe in God. And however you understand the concept of divinity or God, we believe that God is a loving, the absolute most ultimate loving experience, being, deity, father figure, that or parental figure that exists. We believe that God is love as United Methodist. And so if you have ever had a parent that really, really loves you, or you are a parent that really, really loves your children, or if you can experience that feeling of love, and then think about the people that you love, if they were to come to you and be in absolute anguish, would you turn them away? And I guarantee you, if you are a person of love, you would turn no one in anguish away. And on Thursday of this week, I was at the National Prayer Breakfast at the Y, and a colleague friend of mine came up to me and said, I heard you talked about suicide in worship last Sunday. And I said, yeah. He said, my dad experienced death by suicide when I was 3. And growing up in a different faith tradition than United Methodism, I've thought all my life that I would never be reunited with him because he would not be in the eternal presence of God. And he said, so I heard what you said through the grapevine last Sunday, that God loves and God does not turn us away when we are in pain. And so that's what we'll end with today. Let us pray. Gracious God, thank you for being a God of love, and thank you for the ability to have open conversation with the people that are struggling, God, and find themselves in that just utter hopelessness. We just ask that you nudge in them to talk to someone, to reach out to someone. And God, for us who are here that encounter people that are reaching out, help us to see and help us to have clarity of vision and wisdom so that then we can help them get the help that they need. It is a powerful experience to talk about your love, and we feel it, and it is our calling and our responsibility to now go and share that love. Thank you for the individuals that have led this morning, and thank you for all the people who are willing to have open, honest dialogue around such a difficult topic. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. I really do mean it from the depths of my heart when I say thank you for being a group of people that are willing to come and talk about uncomfortable topics, because just from the response that I heard from last week, the fact that you as a church are willing to talk about this has made a difference in the lives of people. So I promise next Sunday is a happy day and we'll do fun, exciting things here. So we invite you to come back, but please go and know that you are never alone. No one here is ever alone. And just ask for help. God will provide people in your lives that will help you. I promise. May you go in peace. Amen.